You're listening to the History Today podcast. In this episode, Mark Horton discusses the inspiration behind The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings. Firstly, a quick word about our January issue, which is out this week. It's the first issue of 2014, and also the first to feature a new design for the magazine. In the cover story, Giorgio Riello writes about cotton's role in the evolution of global economies and international trade, while elsewhere we have articles on Venice in the First World War, the treatment of German prisoners of war, a reassessment of the work of Hugh Trevor Roper, and new monthly columns by Amanda Foreman and Susanna Lipscomb. The January issue is out this week, and it's already available via our digital edition for iPad, Kindle Fire, and Android tablets. New readers can get a free trial subscription by downloading the app from the relevant app store and following the instructions. Now, over to our editor, Paul Lay, to introduce this week's episode of the podcast.
And the January edition of History Today contains a remarkable article by Mark Horton, Professor of Archaeology at Bristol University, who's written the article along with Lynn Forrest Hill. It refers to the inspiration for J.R.R. Tolkien's Ring in The Hobbit, of course, of which a new film is being released currently. And it involves an affair that happened in the late 4th century, involving a Roman by the name of Silvianus. Could you tell us that story, please, Mark?
Yes, well, it is a really rather bizarre set of coincidences, really. A very famous archaeologist called Mortimer Wheeler, in his early career with his wife, were called in to excavate or re-excavate a temple in Gloucestershire at a place called Lydney, dedicated to a local Celtic deity called Modin. And this became a major place of pilgrimage in the 4th century. Modins were associated with healing cults and so forth. And so people would come to the temple to, as it were, be cured. But the other side of Celtic gods was that they could also withdraw life and healing powers at the same time. And this man, Silvianus, while he was trying to get something healed at the temple, put his ring down, probably in the bathhouse, and it was stolen from him. And he believed it was stolen by a local family of robbers called, who he named as Sanaticus. And we know about all this because he did a lead curse, which cursed Sanaticus for stealing his ring and invoking Nodens to deny him his health if he was successful, he would give half the value of the ring to Noden. Now, subsequently, the ring was actually found, not in Gloucestershire, but actually in Hampshire, at Silchester, the well-known Roman town there. And the ring was re-inscribed with Sanaticus's name on the ring, it was converted to a Christian ring from what was probably a pagan ring. It had a sort of bust of Venus on it. So these local band of robbers were Christians stealing rings from the pagans. So it gives some insight into what Christianity and Roman religion was all about in the 4th century. Now, it is an extraordinary story, and we're not absolutely certain whether the ring and the curse tie up. But why it's relevant to Tolkien is that Tolkien was introduced to these excavations by his friend Collingwood and visited the excavations and must have heard about this story at exactly the time that he was writing The Hobbit.
And Collingwood, of course, was a fellow, along with Tolkien, of Pembroke College, wasn't he?
That's right. Tolkien was a fellow of Pembroke College, Oxford, along with Tolkien. You can imagine having dinners together and discussing this extraordinary story. Collingwood had two sides to him. On the one hand, he was an archaeologist, and a Roman archaeologist, and involved in transcribing and collecting Roman inscriptions. But he was also a philosopher, and that was actually what his day job was, and, of course, wrote his really important book a little short time afterwards called The Idea of History. Mm-hmm. So Collingwood was probably the instigator of introducing Tolkien to Wheeler, And one can kind of imagine the two men sort of motoring over the Cotswolds to Lydney. And Tolkien was involved in the excavations by being asked by Wheeler to interpret the Celtic deities that were involved on the site, while Collingwood was transcribing the inscription.
And so how much did this, the discovery of this ring, the conversations that were held between Collingwood and Tolkien and their relationship with Wheeler, who of course was later to become the famous TV archaeologist, how much did this influence Tolkien's writing, but also how can we tell how it influenced Tolkien's writing?
Well, that's really interesting. I mean there's two levels of this. There's, I think, almost a philosophical level, but also a more practical level. A philosophical level, what is it? The main thrust behind Collingwood's ideas of history was in many ways that objects and things could help tell stories, could help understand the past. And he obviously saw that in a professional historical way. But that same idea of objects and things telling stories must have been taken up by Tolkien, and you can imagine them discussing this at a philosophical level. And Tolkien was, various drafts of The Hobbit were developing during the 1920s, but what Tolkien wanted was a device in order to create the centrality of the story. And what made The Ring the famous book it was that device, which was The Ring, which of course was then reworked in the Ring trilogy subsequently, but is there in its embryonic form in The Hobbit. And so it was that need to tell stories, which was the central idea that he gained from his discussions with Collingwood. And in some ways, it's a very modern idea. We now all use materialities and so forth as a way of understanding the past, material culture and so forth, in a way that maybe a previous generation didn't. But what those discussions in the 1920s were have very modern resonance today.
And indeed, we have that. I mean, we've seen the success of Neil McGregor's History of the World in 100 Objects, for instance. This is now pretty much straightforward traditional history now, but then it was really groundbreaking stuff.
Absolutely. And I don't think, I mean, you know, even, you know, 10 years ago, I think a lot of historians didn't like objects. They found them rather curious. They were sort of left to art historians or archaeologists to look at. You know, the documents were where it was all at. But I think now people understand that objects have a peculiar power of narrative of their own, which goes back to The Hobbit and those conversations, motoring across the Cotswolds.
Yeah, and can we look at the way in which the ring, this idea of a ring, this idea of an object, is treated differently in The Lord of the Rings from The Hobbit?
Well, I think we need to go back a little bit, first of all, and say what Tolkien was trying to do in creating this, as it were, story. It was a story of England. It was a story for England. He was a professor of Anglo-Saxon. He wanted to create, as it were, a national story about England. But he was kind of stuck to find that narrative because, you know, on the one hand, you had all those, you know, Germanic reworkings of Wagnerian ring cycle and so forth, which he denied had any relationship to his story of the ring at all. He wasn't had any inspiration for it at all. He wanted to find something that was English and something that had that, as it were, insular resonance. And the ring, I think, really was that key device. And his experience in Lydney, and the relationship in some ways between the Romans and the Saxons at Lydney was also important. And the way in which the Saxons, who subsequently came and lived in that part of Gloucestershire, saw this early world of goblins and people living in little tunnels under the ground and so forth were really important in terms of how he created his story. So the landscape of the Forest of Dean was as as important as the wider, as it were, just the ring itself.
And his scholarship, his Anglo-Saxon scholarship, displays itself too in his concerns with etymology of names.
That's
we look at Nodens in particular.
Absolutely. And I think he also saw some continuity. While he was working on this Celtic god, Noden, he did strongly see a continuity between some of the Celtic and Germanic gods. And saw essentially one notion, a sort of an English-British amalgam. Which later scholarship rather frowned at, but I think modern scholarship is now seeing in much more favourable light that the Germanic element of England, or probably the Germanic element of pre-Anglo-Saxon England, is now beginning to be recognised.
So basically, his intent, his mission is to create a national mythology.
That's right.
And do you think he was not influenced by Wagner in any way, or do you think that's disingenuous?
I don't think he was at all. He hated him. I think it was something, when I think asked, in later life about the relationship between his ring, and Wagner's ring, he said, well, actually, they're just, two rings. they weren't related at all.
And we have this new film of The Hobbit coming out. It's out at the moment. I mean, and we've had the enormously successful trilogy of Lord of the Rings on film as well, which have been huge commercial successes, Peter Jackson's films. What explains the enduring appeal of the books and the film?
Well, and I just think it's an extraordinary combination of the fact that they were rooted in sound scholarship, and in many ways Tolkien was shrouded by fellow academics rather frowned on the whole business. And thought that it was all really rather silly, and it lessened his own scholarly contributions to that. I think probably modern Anglo-Saxonists think he really didn't make a really major scholarly contribution. And when he was appointed Professor of Anglo-Saxon, there was a huge row at the time because Dorothy Whitelock should have had the job, or many people believe, a sound scholar who'd done a serious edition of the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle. But he was a scholar, and combined that rich imagination with that scholarship. And very, very few authors before or since have been able to do that.
And so the fantasy, I mean, and it is very much a fantasy, is underpinned by rigorous scholarship, which I suppose makes it all the more believable, despite it being a fantasy.
Yes, absolutely. It has that air of believability about it. Which is what is enduring, and I suppose what we've been able to uncover in our story is that actually it really was rooted in real archaeology. There's a real place, there's real things that inspired it.
Well, thank you, Mark. It is a fascinating story. You're absolutely right, and it can be read, The Ring That Inspired Tolkien, in the January edition of History Today. Thank you, Mark. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Paul.